Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Alkind.
I'm Joseph Pache.
And I'm Grace Wan. This is your weekly conversation about where we live
and what matters most. We are live.
And we are local.
Every Monday night.
Right here on KALW. Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Joseph Pache. Yesterday was National College Decision Day, when many students across the country are required to commit to the college of their choice. Tonight, we'll be talking with experts about what this year's admission season looked like and what we can expect in future years. Later in the hour, we'll hear from host Ethan Alkind's conversation with Pearl Louise about what it's like to be the mother of a formerly incarcerated man. But first, thousands of nurses from the Sutter Hospitals and the Stanford and Lucile Packard Children's Hospitals walked off the job recently and stalled labor negotiations with these two major Bay Area hospital systems. Why are nurses striking, and how might this impact you? Here to share her perspective on this is Deborah Berger, president of National United Nurses. That is National Nurses United, the union that represents nurses in the Sutter Hospital Network, and a nurse for over 45 years. Deborah Berger, welcome to State of the Bay.
Thank you for having us on.
So, Deborah, why are nurses striking?
Well, if you look at what has happened during the pandemic and actually what was going on before the pandemic, you would understand that nurses are angry and upset and frustrated because they don't have enough staffing to properly provide the care that they know they need to give for their patients. They're stressed. They don't have the equipment, the resources, and the support to do the jobs they need. So most often, it's not even about money. It's about the staffing and the resources. So that's why they're out on strike.
So what are the goals of the nurses at Stanford? I understand that the Sutter nurses have gone back on the job but still don't have a contract either, correct? And so what are their goals as well?
Well, both Stanford has supposedly come up with a settlement for their strike. The nurses at Sutter are still fighting over staffing, and they also want a voice at the table and influence in providing the safe resources they need, such as PPE and transparency in what personal protective equipment is available at the hospitals, who gets it, how they get it, and the ability to influence those decisions. Because during the pandemic, nurses were basically told, here's what you get, you're not getting more, and you won't have any say over it. And it delayed care. It actually harmed patients and nurses, because they had to go to their manager to get the masks or the gowns, gloves, whatever it was they needed. And oftentimes it was in a crisis code situation, and a couple nurses died as a direct result of that.
Wow, that's quite a statement there. So say more.
It's true.
I know that there was a lot of shortages of personal protective equipment early on in the pandemic. What happened later on? Is this still a problem?
Well, when the pandemic first started, there was recommendations from CDC that changed frequently, and nurses were told that they couldn't wear masks, that it would scare the patients, even though nurses knew that because it was a new virus, it was likely to spread very easily, and it did. And unlike other infectious disease policies, which had the equipment at the patient's door. So as nurses went in, you picked up the mask, gloves, gowns, and anything else that you needed, and then go into the room once you were all gowned up. With the pandemic, they locked all of that in the manager's offices, and managers were not on the units at all times. And so nurses were scrambling to get the supplies they needed. Even after some of the supplies improved, they still kept the supplies locked up. They weren't in the carts like they used to be pre-pandemic. And it caused many, many nurses great moral distress and injury to have to continue to operate as if they were children and didn't know when they needed the equipment.
Is that still the case today?
It is the case in some facilities because the managers want to keep costs down. And so they are trying to convince nurses that they need to reuse those masks, to reuse some of the PPE, even though pre-pandemic nurses would have been fired for doing what the managers are currently suggesting nurses do.
So it seems like there's a really clear difference of opinion in and how to manage this scarcity mindset around personal protective equipment.
It's not even an opinion. I mean, when you talk to manufacturers about the N95 masks, about all of the gowns, gloves, and everything, they state clearly on their packaging, it is a one-time use. You go into the patient's room, you change your mask, and you come back out and throw it away. So it really is inappropriate for them to be suggesting that. And
So you mentioned it's potentially not really about salary, about money, and yet it is, right? That is come out in reporting about this, that there is mm-hmm. some pushback on the raises about 4 to 5% per year over the next 3 years, I heard at Stanford. Why is the membership saying that's not enough?
I think if I can't speak for the Stanford nurses, we don't represent them. However, what I do know about nurses in nursing is that it is a highly skilled, highly educated, highly stressful situation to be in, and we don't have the staffing we need. So there should be compensation for the work and education that we do. And so when you look at that and you look at the bottom line of all of these hospitals that have been making billions of dollars in profit, we believe they could take some of that profit and funnel it into resources and support for nurses. For example, making sure that there are enough laboratory personnel, making sure that there's enough support staff in those facilities. And right now there isn't.
And so why is there a shortage of nurses in this country?
Well, it's actually pretty simple. It's a manufactured nursing shortage because the hospital industry and individual hospitals are not adequately staffing the hospitals. So nurses' lives are threatened, patients' lives are threatened, and we're concerned because when you don't have enough staff, you're running basically from one emergency to another. And you just don't have adequate staff to provide the basic care that we know we need to give to our patients. Your nurses are having to make a decision about whether they go in and suction a patient that's on a ventilator or whether they respond to the code for the other patient that's in the other room that's having a heart attack.
How would you describe the work experience of your physician or physician assistant colleagues, nurse practitioners who work side by side with you? Are they having the same sorts of concerns?
Absolutely. All of our colleagues are having the same concerns because when you're actually looking at staffing, shortages of staffing, shortages of resources, shortages of ancillary personnel. It becomes extremely stressful when you're trying to deal with these insufficient staff situations. So I can only assume that in other hospitals, they are also short-staffed as well.
And it seems like after the pandemic, when there was just a relentless need for healthcare professionals, nurses are no exception to that, that this feels like this has gone too far and enough is enough. What do you imagine will actually change from the action that your membership is taking?
Well, if you look at this whole situation, this sort of manufactured crisis, if you want to call it that, this isn't a case of a natural disaster causing an unavoidable crisis. This is because decision makers, whether they're at the government level or whether they're in the hospital industry or the individual hospital, making decisions on not what's best for the patient, but what's best for their bottom line. Mm-hmm. And nurses know that. They see it every single day. And so we have already said we're not going to put our license at risk because we could be sued for giving the wrong medication or the wrong treatment, but we're also not going to put our patients' lives at risk. Mm-hmm. So that's why a lot of nurses have left nursing. And just as we saw in our victory with the staffing ratios, once the hospitals were adequately staffed, nurses came back into nursing because they knew they would be safe and they could provide the care that they needed to give to their patients and what their patients were paying for. Mm-hmm. And they also knew that their license wasn't at risk.
So let's stay with the patients. How do you address concerns about the impact of strikes and work stoppages on patient care? People are saying, you know, if nurses walk out, care suffers, patients suffer. How do you square that?
Well, actually, it is the fault of the employer. And we need to make sure that we hold the employer accountable for patient safety at all times. Our patients, even with us here, are at risk for being injured or death. And we're trying to say we need to change the procedures and the resources and the staffing to improve the the situation. And we give the employer 10 days notice that there will be a strike, so they have plenty of time to bring in travelers to provide that nursing care.
And hospital systems usually use temporary nurses to fill in gaps, both as a regular practice and to fill in during strikes. And that happened here. Why is this practice of a concern to you, especially, again, needing to continue care for patients? Patients can't stop coming into the hospital.
We actually are always concerned about the care that the patients receive, both while they're while we're on strike and even when we're in the hospital not on strike. We have strike teams that will be willing to go and cross the picket line and provide care in emergencies, and we let management know that those nurses are available. We make sure that in legislation, travelers are certified and vetted so that they can provide the care that our patients need. So the patients will do well as long as the employer cancels elective surgeries. They make sure they transfer out the patients to other hospitals and make sure that they can provide the care with the staff that they've arranged to have.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you for joining us, Deborah Berger, president of National Nurses United.
Thank you. for having us on to discuss these important issues.
Coming up next on State of the Bay, we'll talk to University of San Francisco's Ariana Pistorino and college counselor Kaz Riegelman about trends in college admissions. That's right after the break. Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Joseph Pache. Yesterday was a big day for college seniors. Colleges designate May 1st as the day when admitted students have to submit their 150%. Accompanying those record-high application numbers are some intimidatingly low acceptance rates. Harvard admitted a record 3.2% of students who applied, and USC's acceptance rate was the lowest ever at just shy of 13%. But numbers only tell part of the story. How does the decision of many schools to go, quote unquote, test optional with ACT tests and SAT tests fit into this picture? And how did first generation and students of color fare in? And those changes, are they here to stay? Well, here to answer those questions and more, I'm pleased to be joined by Ariana Pistorino, who serves as Assistant Vice Provost for Undergraduate Admissions at the University of San Francisco. Thanks for joining us, Ariana.
Thank you so much, Joseph. And yes, May 2nd. So happy to be here after that deadline.
You saw what the mail brought in. Okay. To you, Kaz Riegelman, college counselor and founder of GetIntoSchools.com, for joining us here on State of the Bay.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So we're going to open up our phone lines a little earlier than usual to hear from you. Did your high school senior apply to college this year? Did they submit their standardized test scores? Did the pandemic make it harder or easier to get into their college of choice? Give us a call. We're at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can send us a message on Twitter. We're at State of Bay. So, Ariana Pistorino with the University of San Francisco, I want to start with you. The pandemic has sent college applications soaring this year, as we mentioned, with over 23,000 students applying for its 2022 fall class. Your university, USF, set a new record with the most applications in the history of its schools. The UC campuses combined received over 210,000 freshman applications this year, the highest number in its system's 154-year history. What is causing this historic increase in applications?
Yeah, absolutely. It was a long reading season for us, I'll say, with over 22,000 applications. And, you know, I think there are a couple of factors here. The first being that, you know, the ease of these pandemic restrictions, the fact that we are back to in-person, absolutely have given students, counselors, parents confidence to apply to college again, knowing I'm going to have that traditional college experience. I think so many students were hesitant, took that gap year, because they wanted college orientation. They wanted a roommate and they weren't going to get that during COVID times. And so I think that's definitely a contributing factor. The second thing, I know we're going to talk a lot more about test optional, but I can't, you know, not factor that in. Absolutely. Not having that barrier, if you will, definitely opened it up for students to apply to more schools than maybe they weren't considering in the first place. And that's on top of the trend where we're seeing students apply on average 10 to 15 schools. And Kaz, I'm sure you can comment on that. But if prior to the pandemic, we were seeing those numbers, with the increase in test optional options, you know, I've seen that balloon. We've had students call our office and say, I'm applying to my 25th college.
Wow.
can I get some advice or can I get some help? So I think all of those really contributed to that surge.
My understanding is also that there, because of the move to virtual recruitment, that schools were also able to reach out to a lot more students perhaps than they would have otherwise.
Yes. Shout out to South Dakota. We were able to actually make visits there virtually, right? That's not a place historically I was sending my team because of financial purposes and frankly, just because they weren't necessarily aware of us. But now we've been able to get to more places virtually, and that is here to stay. When we talk about pandemic implications, the silver lining here is the increased outreach. And now that parents can get involved, they don't have to drive home or come to our campus. They can also just log on the way home or watch a recorded webinar. So that increase in outreach, getting the word out, hopefully not only increased, you know, just knowing about our individual colleges, but just about college going culture in general.
So technology really, really facilitated this process. So Kaz Riegelman, going to you next, 80% of colleges were test optional for enrolling the class of 2022. Why was this such the game changer that Ariana just mentioned? And what has that done to acceptance rates?
So it opens up the floor for anybody feeling like, well, I can put my name in that hat, right? Because they might have self-selected before. They might have said, I don't have the test scores to get into that school. I won't even bother applying. Whereas now they say, well, you know, I'm actually a good student. My GPA is high. I have interesting activities. I'm an interesting person. And they don't need to see my test score. So I'm as good a candidate as anybody else. And they really feel like they can apply, which has both upsides and downsides, right? On an individual level, it can be great for that one kid who might have fit that profile kind of perfectly. And on the other hand, it does contribute to the bigger numbers, which just drive down the statistics for everybody. So it's sort of a mixed blessing. But so that made a huge difference, right? Just, I think as soon as the pandemic hit, we started seeing these numbers that just went crazy for all the schools, all these, especially the upper tier schools, their numbers just increasing drastically in terms of applicants. And that was because more people could. And frankly, also more people needed to apply to more schools because they couldn't visit in person. Mm-hmm. If you can't visit in person, you thought, well, I'll apply to more schools now and then I'll see where I get in. And then by then, maybe the pandemic will be over. Of course, little did we know, but they thought, you know, I'll go visit them once I know where I've been accepted and I'll make my choices based on that. So because people couldn't visit in person, because test scores were impossible to obtain, because the tests kept getting canceled, it really did drive the numbers up. And that tends to, what I've seen too, is that it's snowballing from year to year. So that one year you have more people applying and the acceptance rate goes down. So the next year, people feel like they need to apply to more schools because it's harder to get in everywhere.
Wow.
And that just drives up the numbers of number of applicants. So it just kind of keeps snowballing.
Interesting. Something that I think otherwise would have been touted as a way to increase access by removing what some people say is a measuring stick that's very fraught, potentially with bias, is actually causing a particularly unintended consequence there. How, in fact, did this impact the number of students who are first generation or from communities of color in terms of not only applying when maybe they wouldn't have and then getting accepted?
Yeah. Am I taking this?
Sorry, Kaz, I was still with you there. Go ahead.
Yeah, and it seems to have somewhat mixed effect. Like everything else, it's not one clear answer that we can all point to. So a lot of the schools did take this as an opportunity to get a more diverse class because they didn't feel like they were beholden to those test scores maybe that they were in the past. And I mean, I know a lot of the Ivies, they have up to close to 70% now, like just under 70% of students identifying as students of color. So that's a pretty amazing number and the highest percentage that's ever been.
Wow, that's pretty high, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, some of the schools really, they're managing to, and they're attracting all across the board, right? It's lots of new first generation students, you know, they're giving out more scholarships. They're attracting students who can't pay for the full crazy tuition by themselves. They're really attracting across the board. And so that part's great. But then I think you also see some of the non-elite schools, their numbers are falling a little bit and they're not having that same effect.
Right.
So it's a little bit like what we see in society as a whole. Like the gap just seems to be getting wider, sort of, right? You know, the sort of haves and have nots. And it feels like that's happening with the schools too, which is a little bit heartbreaking, right? You want more range for everybody, especially when there's this much demand, and instead it seems to be shrinking.
Yeah, we'll get more to that in a moment. Ariana, I want to bring you in. The University of San Francisco was ahead of the curve and went test optional way before the pandemic. 2018, that was like decades ago, right? What have the results been for USF?
Yeah, so so we made the decision in 2019 and then started with the following class. And, you know, for us, I think early on, we recognized that there was not a correlation, at least at University of San Francisco, between test scores and academic success in college. And this was across the board. It didn't matter what discipline it was, even something like nursing, which is one of our more popular programs that requires you to take a test, the NCLEX exam, right, to become a registered nurse. Students were still performing the same, whether they came in with a super quote unquote high test score or an average one. And so our first year that we decided to go test optional, you know, over 80% of our students apply test optional. And we admitted over 70% of those students. And we're seeing them thrive. We've heard positive feedback from our faculty members that they didn't see a difference. There wasn't this idea that, oh, this is the class where we don't have test scores for them. They were performing and thriving on our campus as those who had not submitted test scores.
I see. And then and that means that retention was also good with this group. OK.
Yeah. So that's something that we're absolutely tracking, especially as, you know, we hope to work with our faculty and begin to work with administration to become test free. We are looking at our big brothers and sisters, our UCs and Cal States, and looking at the good work they've done to say, hey, no more of this. And we are very interested in that path. And obviously retention is a big piece, a big data point in that push for test free.
And so it sounds like you also saw a surge in applications when you first dropped the SAT, ACT requirement or made it optional.
You know, we did. I'd say, you know, one thing to USF's credit is that diversity serving first generation students has just been a part of the fabric of who we are. And so while it helped us move the needle a little bit, we were already, you know, had about 30% first generation students on our campus. And this has just allowed us to maintain and serve that population and continue to be yet another voice saying test scores are not a requirement for college and do not necessarily indicate your future success.
So let's close out this topic because I'm sure we could spend the rest of the conversation on it. So what is your advice, Kaz, for applying freshmen for next year? Should they submit their test scores? Maybe if they're great, why not? It'll help them. They can't hurt them. And for both of you, do you imagine that this is going to go beyond 2022-23 admission cycle?
So what I tell my students is certainly take a diagnostic test, figure out which test you prefer, the SAT or the ACT, see if you happen to be a good tester or not. And then also it depends on what schools you're targeting, see what sort of their average SAT, ACT scores are. And so some of the students I counsel absolutely take the test. They study for the test. They prep for it. They might even take it more than once. And others, we say, it's not worth it. That's not your strength. It's not going to help you in your applications. And that's okay. You have other things that are wonderful and that show who you are. So I try not to emphasize it too much. But for some kids, it's just another piece of the puzzle and it shows a little bit more. And optional means you can send it in.
Right.
But then, of course, we have to strategically go through every single school they're going to apply to. Do we send your score to that school, to this one, to this one? We go through each one and you can choose whether or not to send it.
I see.
So it actually is a little time consuming.
So do you
and
think
whether or not
it's coming back? Yeah. Is it going to come back?
I don't know. I don't think it's going to come back right away. And partly it's because this is the great experiment everybody wanted to do. And the first couple of years have been forced on them. And really, they had to go test optional because students genuinely could not get hold of the test.
Right.
And this is a really great chance to see, okay, those first cohorts that came in test optional or test free, how did they fare? You know, what are their graduation statistics? Where do they go for graduate school? Like, does this have any effect at all? And if it doesn't, they may never come back.
Right.
There are a couple schools that are bringing them back already, but that's sort of the minority. I think the majority are going to stay test-free at least to like finish out the 4 or 5 year experiment.
Got it. Arianna, I imagine USF is going to stay the course.
Oh, yes. Yes, yes, yes. There is no turning back.
All right. Well, I want to reintroduce the program. This is State of the Bay on KALW, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Joseph Pache, and we're discussing the changes to and challenges of the college admissions process. Did your student find the competition for college steep this year? How many schools did your student apply to? Did your college freshman feel prepared for school after a pandemic of online learning and easier grading? Well, you can join us by giving us a call at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org or find us on Twitter. We're at State of Bay. So we have actually a listener question. Jill from Mill Valley writes, what about grade inflation? My son did very well academically second semester of his junior year, only to find out that everyone was given automatic A's for that semester. How can the colleges sort through who earned their grades and who didn't? And then when they don't have test scores, like, how do they decide? Why don't we start with you, Arianna?
Yeah. Oh, it's such a great question. You know, we get asked this all the time. And what I bring it back to is, you know, the SAT or ACT is one or two Saturdays of an entire student's life. A high school transcript is 3 years, sometimes 3.5, depending on when they apply, years of academic work. It gives me the opportunity to say, what are the trends in their grades? What classes did they take? You know, where is it that they're majoring in, and do they have an interest, and does that reflect on their transcript? So there is so much there, more than enough, really, for us to be able to make, you know, that judgment call, if you will, or accurately figure out, are you academically prepared and ready? So even though that test score isn't there, we've got other things to take a look at. And what I like to always remind families of is, you know, it's just one piece of the whole puzzle. When we're reading an application, we are never going to admit or deny a student solely based on one factor. It's going to be a combination of factors. And so it's never the case that we're looking at a transcript or we're looking at an entire record and say, you know, because of this test score, that's what pushes them over the edge. It's the test score and the transcript and the letter of rec and the essay and what have you. To comment on the grade inflation piece, you know, part of the work that we do is really getting out there and working with students in their communities and in their high schools. I have recruiters who have worked in the same territory for 10 years. They know these high schools, they know these students, and we have that historical data, you know, in our CRM. We're aware of what the grade trends are and what makes sense as we're reading applications of students from the same school or maybe the same community, or even when we're taking a look at out-of-state applicants versus in-state applicants.
So, Kaz, Arianna's describing what many have called a holistic approach to assessing a candidate's ability to thrive and succeed at the college that they're applying to. How widespread is this approach? And in fact, are there colleges that would not, are there no colleges that would say, oh, no, sorry, that GPA doesn't make the grade. That's going to be a no-go here.
Oh, there are absolutely colleges that, I mean, they might not officially say that, but I think the truth is, you know, MIT is just bringing back test scores, actually. So now you have to submit your test scores and you're submitting your GPA. And the truth is, if you're applying with a 2.2 to MIT, low grades, low test scores, and, you know, in math and science, and you're saying, hey, I want there, your chances are incredibly slim. I mean, I think that that would pretty much prevent you from getting a spot. But that's sort of at an extreme end, right? If you're talking about the tiny variations, right? You have really excellent students applying with like tiny variations. And as Arianna was saying, different schools do it different ways. Do they have different systems for GPAs? Some of them weight it, some of them don't. So you can't sit and nitpick like, oh, our cutoff is 3.7 and we'll never look at somebody below a 3.7. Nobody gets that nitpicky. Because those specific numbers could be meaningless on a very large scale. You have to look at the schools individually. You know, I think the grade inflation from the pandemic did make it, frankly, a little bit harder to tell some candidates apart. I think the recommendation letters must have been, you know, just that extra little bit important, right? Because a teacher still sort of knows the difference between an A that was given because everybody got an A because they were preserving mental health during the pandemic, and an A from a really top-notch student who's doing amazing work. And I think that that's partly where that comes through also. Mm.
So, Cass, staying with you, this idea of the holistic approach has been touted also as a way to level the playing field for applicants from underprivileged backgrounds, whether first-generation applicants or applicants from communities of color that are also low socioeconomic status. Tell us how the pandemic, all of the pieces that we've talked about tonight, how has that impacted students of color in terms of even deciding to apply and their ability to secure an acceptance?
So I think in terms of applying, you know, I think it did alter numbers in some ways. It even, you know, lowered community college applications, right? I think in some parts of society where money was really an issue during the pandemic, and even if you can get scholarships, right, it still costs something to go to school, right?
It's more than just something.
Yes, it costs quite a lot.
Yeah.
But even if you get, you know, full tuition paid for, it's still, there are extra costs of traveling and books and food and just living expenses and whatnot. And also the cost of not working, right? The lost income. So I think, you know, some of those numbers did go down. So I think there probably were some people who didn't apply because of that. On the other hand, at some of the really elite schools, it was a really wonderful opportunity for people who normally wouldn't have considered a school because of the test scores that would have scared them off, or because they couldn't go visit the school in person, that might have scared them off. Well, now nobody could visit in person. Everybody was doing it online. They were just doing their information sessions and tours online. Hmm. So you had quite a good number of people who were from underprivileged backgrounds and underserved communities who were applying and getting in because they were really able to be looked at on an even more playing field. So some of those, it's again, it's a little bit, the statistics are sort of extreme at both ends.
Yeah, Black applicants to the UC system have grown by 25% system-wide, with an even greater surge at the most competitive campuses, including 57% at UC Berkeley and 47% at UCLA, with increases in the yield of applicants from those communities to getting acceptance letters. What do you make of this, Ariana Pistorino from USF?
Yeah, I think it's so important. I think Kaz did a great job of talking about it. I think there were a lot of concerns about were students of color being served properly? And, you know, virtual learning meant that the college counselor could no longer walk down the hall and say, hey, did you submit that FAFSA? Hey, can we review your financial aid package and talk about your options or talk about this process? And so I know that was a big concern for us. And especially in the beginning of the pandemic, we were really seeing that trend nationally in the data that lower, you know, fewer students were submitting the FAFSA and fewer first generation students were applying. And so I think over the course of those two major impacted years where we were really under lockdown, there was great concerns. It seems, though, that colleges were able to step up and say, okay, what can we provide via virtual services? How can we assist those high school counselors? And what, you know, we ended up offering far more financial aid webinars, again, leveraging that tech to make sure that these students had the resources they need, even if they couldn't get them at their high school from no fault of their counselor, but just from, again, a lack of access to those answers, to that normal counseling that might happen as they're, you know, walking to lunch, if you will.
So we have an email from Mira who says, I hear many people are wisely pursuing trades such as plumbing and construction rather than going into student loan debt in order to get a professional job that is likely to be offshored or eliminated by technology in the near future. I understand pursuing higher education out of a genuine love of learning, but this can be done for little or no cost. It seems highly unwise to go into debt in our extremely unstable economic environment. Can you please comment? Who wants to take that one?
Oh, yeah, I'm happy to. You know, I kind of snap that question a little bit, snaps over here for that, because, you know, I think that that's valid. I think there is a lot out there about student loan debt that is creating such a negative perception of the college experience. And even as an enrollment professional, you know, what we say is, while we want everyone to go to college, ultimately a family has to do what's right for them. And when we talk about what's right for them, we're also talking about financially what's right for them. And so I think when we talk about costs, you know, we are so lucky here in California to have the community college system, and to have an affordable way to access college. But our community colleges also offer fantastic trade programs. And knowing that maybe that's the best right step for a student, you know, we're happy on the college end to maybe support them in 5 years when they say, all right, I'm kind of ready maybe for a managerial role. And now I want to go back and get, you know, my BA in management or business or what have you. And we're going to be happy and ready to validate the years of work experience they've had and add that diversity of perspective in our classrooms. So I think it's definitely, you know, we hear that more and more, and the value of a liberal arts education, right? Literally my job to talk about that and to convince families, especially when they're coming in with perspectives like that.
So Kaz, picking up on that, community colleges seem to have been hardest hit here. Enrollment in the California community college system was down almost 10% from pre-pandemic levels. And I would have thought, with the expense of college and classes being more online, more students would have turned to community colleges during the pandemic. What is going on here?
I think that's a lot about both the combination of economics and the pandemic itself. I think, you know, people were saying, okay, do I really want to sit in my house for another year and do all of my classes virtually, right? Nobody knew at what point this would end. And so I think a lot of people, some people took gap years, you know, even once they were admitted to college, they deferred their admittance. And I think even at the community college level, people were saying, well, I could spend money to go to community college, but frankly, it's not very pleasant to be sitting in my room at home doing all of my classes online. Pretty sick of that. So maybe I'll work now. And, you know, when the pandemic's over, then I can go to community college. So we're seeing more people who I think are taking a gap year or even two, just sort of waiting till this is over a little bit and they can go back and have a more normal experience. And that's at both levels. And then, of course, we also have now, you know, higher hourly wages, you can earn more money. So a lot of people are saying, well, I could study in my room or I could work and make some money while I'm waiting to go next year.
And Arianna, you get the last word in like 30 seconds. Any parting tips for next year's graduating high school seniors who are starting to contemplate where they're applying?
Yes. Start early and take a look at those essay questions. You know, the supplement is their chance to really talk about who they are and why they're a good fit for these schools. And that takes time. So start early.
All right. Well, thank you both for joining us. Arianna Pistorino of USF and Kaz Riegelman, who has the website getintoschools.com. We'll have links to that on our webpage at State of the Bay on KLW.org. So thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Coming up after the break, we have Ethan Elkind talking with Per Louise about her experiences as a mother of an incarcerated man. This is State of the Bay. Stay with us.
Early one morning, I was all locked up in jail. Early that Monday morning, I was all locked up in jail.
So our guest tonight is Pearl Louise. Pearl is part of the Formerly Incarcerated People's Performance Project, an ensemble of performers who bring their life stories of how the penal system has affected them to the stage. Though not incarcerated herself, Pearl's eldest son went to jail in 2007 at the age of 19. And as Pearl will tell you on stage, when your child goes to jail, the whole family does time. So here to tell a mother's story is Pearl Louise. Welcome, Pearl.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure to be here. Thanks.
No, glad to have you. And so, Pearl, as part of the Formerly Incarcerated People's Performance Project, you do a monologue called The Call.
Yes.
Can you tell us what it felt like to get that first call from your son in prison?
The first call I got from my son was from jail that he got arrested. And I was so upset about that. I just felt not again, you know, because I have so many family members that's been incarcerated. So I know the jailhouse call. And I didn't think my son, I would get a call from him.
And what you said you had a lot of emotions going, I can only imagine the emotions you had going through your mind. What would you, you know, what would sort of your advice be for someone in that situation?
The advice would be don't panic. Don't get upset because the person on the other line is very upset. They're in jail and they want to hear all the positive things. Listen to them. Why are they there? What's the problem and what their mindset is? Because sometimes they can call you. They can be stoned out of their mind. They could be drunk. They could be angry. And there was a lot of times I had to calm my son down, try to get the story.
And in your monologue, you say that when your child goes to jail, the whole family does time.
Yes.
Can you explain what your son's incarceration meant for you and your whole family?
It meant a lot because he's the oldest child. I had so much planned for him. I didn't think that this would happen. And it affected me as a mother and especially his siblings. He thought he let them down. And to be honest, I told him, you did.
So, Pearl, I imagine that there was a real financial burden with your son's incarceration. Can you describe what that was like?
Yes, there is a financial burden. For example, prisoners get a care package quarterly, and sometimes the packages could be $300, $400. Also, the phone calls that my son would make to me, which was extremely expensive. It's been a while. But sometimes my phone bills would be about $400 a month just for phone calls. And when you tell your child, I can't catch this phone today, it's costing me money. And I always would feel so guilty about it because we would talk on the phone for hours. Just so he says, he calls me sometimes, he says, Mom, I just want to hear your voice. That's all. He would have a cellie. They call like a roommate that's in there. One of his cellmates, he got on the phone and he told me, ma'am, I just want to let you know, I'm going to watch out for your son. I told him not to do no knuckleheads because I'm not getting out, ma'am, but I want your son to get out. So when I hear things like that, that's really nice.
I imagine that it was just the conditions for him in the prison were really stressful for him, even beyond just the lack of contact. Were there examples you could share about situations he was in that were really stressful for him?
My son is gang affiliated. And when you're gang affiliated, you're treated different in prison. My son was in maximum security. And when you're gang affiliated, you have to be part of the family that's in gangs. And there are certain things my son had to do. Excuse me. In order to survive. I would like to share it. He said, Mom, I may have to do something. I may not make it. But tell my brother and sister, I love them. Because I have to produce. That's what they would say. Mom, if I don't do what I'm supposed to do, then they're going to do to me what I'm supposed to have done to the other person. And when you get that, how can you sleep at night? So that's why I always kept it to me, this journey with my son, because nobody really understands. So that's what I went through.
Well, you know, I think you described a little bit about what it meant for your family, too. I'm wondering, what did it change for you just sort of in terms of your social relations with people? I mean, there's a real stigma around this. So how did you navigate that?
Yes, it is. When someone goes to prison and they're gone for a time, you have to either lie or let them know. And usually I just don't let them know. We just don't share it that much. Because why? After one question, you get another question. and another. And then you start getting judged. And I didn't want to deal with that. I think a lot of my bandwidth was just dealing with my child that's in prison.
And how did you get involved in the Formerly Incarcerated People's Performance Project to kind of channel all the emotions and experiences that you went through?
Well, I heard about it through the website. And I was saying, wow, all the performers were formerly incarcerated. And I wrote a letter, an email to the producer, and I just kind of put my feelings out that there's another side of the story that needs to be told. All the people that's left behind while the families are in prison.
Has it been healing for you to participate in the stage performances, just process what you've been through with this whole experience?
Yes, it has. I felt I couldn't share this. But then I said, you know what, Pearl? People need to hear about this. People really should. And the response that I got was so overwhelming with people. They encouraged me to continue, that I'm not a bad person. I didn't bring a menace to society. My son now is a productive tax-paying citizen. He got a second chance. And I think of that lifer who said, I'm going to make sure your son gets out of here. I think about people like that.
Well, I'm glad to hear it. I really thank you for just sharing what you've been through.
Oh, sure.
Obviously, you know, important for you to do so, but I think for so many others to hear what you have to say.
Thank you so much.
I want to get into a little bit of what it was like for you just having to manage this situation. And so what was visiting your son like?
I didn't visit my son. I didn't visit him because he was so far away. I'm in the Bay Area and he was in the Southern California. And I was so guilty about it, but I knew that through my conversations with other family members and on the news and reports, a lot of family members cannot visit their family. It's just too far. People don't have the money. So you have the letters. I sat there and I wrote a lot of letters. I made his brothers and sisters write letters, and he was so welcoming to get those letters. And also talk to him on the phone. I told him, son, I won't be able to visit you down there. You got to understand. And he said, that's okay, Mom. That's okay.
Well, and he went in when he was 19.
Yes.
And came out as a 29-year-old.
Yes.
Did you observe prison changing him?
The only thing that really changed him, he didn't know all the doodads that's out there, the telephones and all the electronics that's happening. But for him, no, he didn't. He didn't really change. The reason why I wasn't surprised when he got out, because I stayed in contact with him.
Yeah, how's he doing?
He's doing fine, but he's struggling a little bit. He has a job. He's a trucker now, and that's a business on his own, but he really loves it.
And any advice you'd have for people going through this situation right now, but, you know, maybe could benefit from understanding a little bit more of the perspective that you would bring to this?
I would tell them, you're going to go into a whole new world. You're going to have a steep learning curve because the system treats you just as bad sometimes as the inmate. And don't take it personal. Don't feel guilty about it. You don't have to tell everybody everything. There are help now that's out there. You may feel alone, but you're not alone.
Well, it's really wonderful advice. And I appreciate your courage in expressing what you've been through and sharing your insights. And also just want to thank you for taking the time to speak with us. And I also wish you a very happy upcoming Mother's Day. That's Pearl Louise. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. This has been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
And you can find information about her show on the website, the Formerly Incarcerated People's Performance Project, or catch Pearl Louise's next performance in Oakland, May 13th, 14th, or 15th at Piano Fight.
Before we go tonight, I want to take a moment to say goodbye. As we all know all too well, all things come to an end. We just don't know how and when. So tonight will be the last time I will be signing off on State of the Bay. events unfolded quickly and unexpectedly and have to do with circumstances mostly out of my control. Goodbyes are never easy, but it's important to take the time and effort to do them well. So here goes. As I reflect back on my 16-year journey, first with City Visions and now with State of the Bay, I realize that I've had such a great privilege to be associated with a KLW institution for more than half of its 30-year run. Although my day job is in medicine, I've had a lifelong interest in media. I even have cassette recordings of myself as a kid growing up in Queens, New York, playing newscaster aside my older sister. I never could have imagined that several decades later, I would be behind a microphone at a public radio station in San Francisco, hosting a live radio show about all things Bay Area. It may sound unoriginal, but there are so many people to thank. Judith Sansone, a colleague of mine at the San Francisco Department of Public Health, who brought me on as a City Visions producer back in April of 2006. Rose Levinson, the creator of this program, who entrusted me with the host chair when she left the program, also after a 16-year run. I'm still in touch with Rose, who's gone on to get her PhD, write several books, and resettle in the UK. And she's been so delighted to see the experiment she started back in 1991 continue and evolve. I also want to thank the producers and co-hosts who over the last 16 years volunteered their time to turn out a top-rate show every week with professionalism, creativity, risk-taking, and oh so much grace under pressure. Without you all, there would be no show. The same goes for the many guests I've met whose innovation, spirit, passion, and commitment to elevate the public discourse makes this show possible. I have truly learned so much from each and one, every one of you, and that's no exaggeration. Many thanks as well to our engineers who make sure things go smoothly and spring into action whenever a live show goes awry, which has happened on more than one occasion over the last 16 years. And I also want to give special thanks to the leaders of KALW who have believed in us and supported us in ways both big and small. And then, of course, there are you, the listeners, who have been the guiding compass for me and the team. I hope I've done my duty to inform, engage, and perhaps even challenge you. I am grateful for the privilege to have been a part of your lives. So while this chapter is closing for me, I sincerely hope this isn't the last time you will invite me into your homes, your cars, or wherever, whenever, and however you listen. I'm already working on my next project, and you can find out more by following me on Twitter. I'm at Joseph Pace Radio. That's Joseph P-A-C-E Radio. And that's it. Well, that's State of the Bay for this week. I want to thank all of our guests and listeners this evening for being part of the conversation. For more information about this and other State of the Bay shows, visit the State of the Bay page on kalw.org. And if you have any questions or comments about anything you heard tonight, let us know. Email us anytime at stateofthebay@kalw.org. Next week on our show, we look at how Elon Musk's purchase of Twitter will impact San Francisco and the broader Bay Area. My thanks tonight to producers Jillian Emblad, Chris Nooney, and Wendy Holcomb. David Kwan was the engineer, and Joanne Marr was our board operator. For the last time, this is Joseph Pace. Good night. Thanks for listening. Be well, and be good to each other.